This is the greatest sports person that's ever lived, pound for pound, and one of the most tortured. I challenge you in the comments to name another sports person, alive or dead, that's ever dominated their sport anymore. This guest brutally opens up about his addictions and all the tournaments he had to miss because he was in rehab and couldn't do any drug testing. He openly shares his mistakes, his regrets, and how 100 times a year he would self-sabotage. One of the most open humans and most fascinating guests we've had in over 1,000 episodes of the show, Ronnie O'Sullivan talks about his legacy and how he'd like to be remembered. I hate long intros, but before we get into this, let me know in the comments how you think Ronnie O'Sullivan will be remembered. Possibly one of the most controversial sports figures that's ever lived. A lot of people talk about not getting around the wrong people. So let's help people define the wrong kind of people. What are their traits and habits?
Yeah.
Don't have to mention names, but you know, how do we avoid these people?
I think in a way it's sort of like you want someone that's going to support you no matter what, you know, through the tough times, the high times. And yeah, listen, if you're being a bit of a dick and you get home, you know, you're going to get told and you're going to go, oh, well, I've overstepped the mark. But when you're out there doing battle or you're doing something, it's like, you know, support that person, do what he's got to do. And like I said, it's like choosing your moments and your time. So, you know, nobody's perfect. But I just think having that person that's behind you, and you know they're behind you. And I see it with certain snooker players. They've got that person that's behind them, and you just think, wow, that's a great asset for him, that he's got a team of people around him that are just there for him. Do you know what I mean? It's all about him, and it's all about, you know, having that support network. And a lot of, you know, some people that I've had, they come to talk to me, and all they want to do is take, you know, can I have your waistcoat? Can I have this? Can I have that? Can I have this? Can I have that? And you're like, I'm just here to play snooker, and all they're interested in is sort of like, you know, can you sign this? Can you sign that? Can you sign this for my friend? Can you say hello to my Uncle Terry? And, you know, can you come around and give, you know, and you're like, wow, you know what I mean? Can't we just chill out here? You know, just have a nice bit of dinner and tea and put the TV on and just have a bit of a laugh. So I think sometimes you just got to, like, and it took me a while because I'm a bit of a people pleaser. So I just kind of, I never want to disappoint anyone. But I've just learned over the last, I've probably learned more in the last 5 years than I did in the previous 40. I'm a little bit more, you know, brutal with my, who I have around me, you know, and are they actually good to have around me, you know, and it's kind of like, so like in a way I'll invite one, you know, I've got three or four really, really good friends, and I think if I invite him, but then I invite two people that, you know, not bad people, but they're just liberty takers really, they're going to affect my good friend. So it's about, you know, I have to be careful who I invite and where that, you know. So sometimes I'll have my good friend with me, but I said to the other guy, look, I can get you tickets, but, you know, there's no backstage stuff going on because, you know, it's just not going to happen. So you just kind of have to put people in certain places in a way. And listen, I mean, Steve Peters, when he first started working with me, he'd come in my dressing room, there'd be like 8-9 people in there. And he went to me and said, who are all these people? I went, well, that's him. It was like having a rave in my dressing room, right? And he says, you're supposed to be playing a snooker match, you know what I mean? Like, you know, he's supposed to be getting ready for this. And I'm like, yeah, I know, Steve, but I can't say no to him. And in the end, he was like, Ronnie, you know, and it was just like, and it was so hard. So I'd kind of go to a different room to talk to Steve. And then once I finished with Steve, I'd go back to my room and there's like 10, 15 people in there. And in the end, I thought, this ain't no good either, do you know what I mean? So I kind of just, when I'm at tournaments now, I just have me and Steve, and I really get the best out of Steve, and we have a fantastic relationship. Or then another tournament, it'd be me and Damien, and that's great, and we have a fantastic relationship. And, you know, they're my two most important people, if you like, when I'm at snooker. You know, Damien is unbelievable, and Steve is unbelievable.
Damien, painting guy.
So, yeah, he loves snooker, and he's been a fantastic friend to me, and it's so different with Steve. It's very
Damien. Damien Hurst.
Yeah. With Steve, it's very, like, you know, machine-like, but with Damien, it's like, you're a king. Who cares? You know what I mean? Like, it will come when it comes, and that's just because he's creative. You know, he'll go and paint when he's feeling creative. And if he's not feeling creative, It's like, it's not happening today. And he always says, I don't know how you do it. At 2 o'clock, you've got to play. He said, but you might not feel like playing at 2 o'clock. And I go, I know. He says, I just couldn't do that. He said, and all these people watching you as well. So he totally gets it. Because, you know, I play snooker in a creative way. And some days I don't feel like being creative. And I'm not a machine. So it's very hard for me to go out there and go from creative person to machine-like. But I've had to learn that because it's the nature of the sport. You know, a sport demands discipline from you, you know, like to do things when you don't actually want to do it, you know. People paid their money, you know. I don't feel like it today, I can't do it. It's different for Damien. He can pick and choose when he does, but... and I'd love to have that option, and that's what practice is like. Some days I go in, I have a 20-minute rule. If after 20 minutes I'm not enjoying it, cue goes away in the case, and I go down to the restaurant, and I eat lovely food, and I read a book, and I have a laugh, and I have a wonderful day. Because if it ain't good after 20 minutes, it certainly ain't going to be good after 2.5-3 hours. So I kind of learn to sort of like minimise the shit, if you like, you know, and just kind of, you know, if I can just have 10% of shit and 90% of good, I'm going to have a good life, you know. And if you look at over a 10, 15, 20 year period, I'm better off managing my life like that and probably will get the best out of myself if I just make sure that, you know, there's much more good times than there are bad times. So, yeah.
All right. You did say earlier that some people say, I wouldn't change anything about my life. And you went, maybe one main thing you'd change?
For sure, I would never have picked up a drink. And I always think for any youngster out there, don't.
Yeah, where's the upside in that?
Yeah, there absolutely is no upside. Don't, you know, try not smoke, don't drink, all them sort of stuff. Keep yourself fit. So yeah, I mean, I just think lead a healthy life. You know, study successful people. You know, don't necessarily have to be in your sport. Steve Davis was a great role model for me. Michael Jordan, he was a basketball player. But again, I kind of changed the way I approached snooker through watching Harry approach his basketball. You know, he was an athlete, you know, in bed early, eating the right foods. And I thought, well, why should I be any different? You know, you listen to Jeff Bezos. He likes to be in bed, gets his 8 hours sleep, likes to do, you know, doesn't like to pack up his diary. And I just think, well, you can learn. He's a successful person. So I can learn something from him that I can apply to my own life. And I just think, just read, you know, just tuning up. It's like a Ferrari, it needs tuning up. And sometimes just a little tweak here and there can make all the difference, you know. And I just think
down the A1.
Yeah, down the A1. And I just think, yeah, so there's a lot of things I would have done differently, you know, like not drinking and I probably, it's a bit late now, but I probably wouldn't have took snooker up either. That was another mistake
I made. Should we just cut?
No, yeah. I'm being honest with you. I mean, I always say to young kids and their parents come up to me, I said, don't let him play. I said, don't let him play this game. My own kids, I was like, you're not playing snooker. I said, if you decide to play snooker, you're on your own. I said, because I'm not supporting that. It's a bad sport. It can cause you a lot of damage. Unless you're Stephen Hendry, Steve Davis, John Higgins, Mark Williams, me, Judd Trump, Selby, Robertson, forget it, the others are wasted, you know, it's just a waste of a life. And even some of them names that I've mentioned to you, even some of them I just think, yeah, they're good at what they do, but if they could equally be good at something else, I would have said, go for the other thing. Because I just think snooker's just a really, really tough sport. You know, you're stuck indoors, there's no natural light, draw the curtains, pitch black. You're in there for 5-6 hours. You don't talk to anyone because you're focused and you've got to concentrate. Any little bit of concentration, you can ruin your day if it's broken. And you just think, hey, that's not healthy. Do you know what I'm saying? That's not a good way to spend your life. You know, if you look at a lot of snooker players, they don't know how to have a conversation because they don't talk. And you just think, really, life's all about, you know, getting the buzz and the joy of life. So for me, I've kind of detached from snooker, you know, for the last 20 years. They don't see me at a venue. A lot of players go, what do you do? And I'm like, well, I have a life, you know. I like to enjoy doing other things. You know, I can turn up at a match at 2 o'clock. I'm on at 2, but at 1:50, I put my shirt and tie on. I don't need to practice. You know, I'm not that bothered. You know, if I, you know, I've been playing this game 30 years or whatever. You know, if I ain't ready now, I'm, you know, another 20 minutes on the practice table and another this, and it ain't making no difference. So I kind of, I've kind of learned to just sort of, like I said, you know, I wouldn't have chosen it. I probably would have chose golf. I probably would have chose Formula One. Or some sort of driving thing. I love driving. I just you never feel unhappy driving a car at speed and sort of getting the grip round the bend. So I think I would have chose a different sport or a sport that allowed me to be more at home. You know, so the travelling can be hard with snooker. So like if maybe you're a footballer or something. You know, you get to stay at home Monday to Friday. You go away for the weekend. Yeah, that would suit me down to the ground. You know.
Did you at one point get quite into, was it Buddhism?
Yeah.
Because that sounded a little bit Buddhist, what you said there,
okay.
In a way. What got you into that and how did that help you?
I think what kind of got me into that was I went into a rehab, I think it was in 2000. I was having some problems with drinking and smoking a bit of dope at the time and stuff like that. And I kind of got to a point where it wasn't fun, it wasn't really giving me the release that it did when I first started. And I kind of thought, I need to really knock this on the head because obviously, you know, I was getting drug tested quite a lot as a player. And I thought, you know, this dope stays in the system for like 30 days, you know. So like I was starting to have to miss tournaments, miss events, just because I thought I might get tested. And I'd rather not play than get tested again for cannabis because I got done once for it. And so I was kind of like, I thought, I'm screwed here. Unless I find a way to get off this weed and this beer, I'm like, you know, maybe it's time to retire. And I was like, I was only like 24. And I thought, what else am I going to do in my time? I only know how to play snooker. It's not like I could go and do anything else. So I didn't stick myself into a rehab. Somebody else did. I thought, that's a bit harsh though, you know. Like, I thought that was for hardcore addicts, you know. And but for me, it was probably the best thing I ever done, you know. So I got a month off of everything, came out, and I've never looked back really. And part of the process of kind of getting well, if you like, was to try and find a higher power. A lot of people went to religion. I thought, I'm not really down with rules, you know, I'm not good with rules. So I thought, anyone telling me that I've got to do this and do that and do this and do that, I was like, you know, but I tried it and I can see why people like it and it can work. It can work for some people. It can work for some people. But it just wasn't going to work for me. So Buddhism was kind of like it was something that I thought maybe kind of could give me some structure, give me some peace, because I needed a bit of peace of mind, you know, within this snooker depression, within this sport that I really think is a tough sport, well, it is for me, some people it might not be, I need to find that little bit of inner peace, you know, that place where I can take myself to and just kind of like feel all right about myself, you know, whether I play well or not. If I can take myself to that place where I think, you know, life's okay, then I'm able to probably cope with the demands of snooker. So Buddhism was a good one for me because I kind of, it allowed me to just kind of just try and just find that contentment without handing my life over to this higher power that already had the plan made. You know, so for me, when I looked at like a God in a way, I kind of thought, if he's already made the decisions, what's the point of me putting the effort in? I mean, I could try really hard here all day, and yet he's already made the decision. And that really bothered me. But with Buddhism, there was none of that. It was just like, you just find your own peace, your own rhythm, and kind of like, you still have an element of control of what the outcome can be, you know? I never like to feel like I have no control out of the outcome of any situation. So Buddhism worked really well for me, and I still kind of hold on to some of them teachings, you know, because sometimes...
What was the main teachings you got from it?
I think what it was just about, you know, just, you know, like you'd have, let's say you'd have three people, one person you didn't really like, one that was neutral and one that you really liked, and you kind of wish them all the same sort of happiness, the same sort of good luck, and this, you know, so you kind of like, they said there'd be people on a snooker tour that I'd think, oh, I really can't stand him. But I'd have to start wishing him really happiness for him and his family. And actually, it made me feel a lot more okay with him, you know. And in the end, I had a better relationship with this guy. So I totally bought into it in a way, you know, because why wouldn't you want to wish someone well, you know, because I didn't get on well with him, you know, that, you know, he's still a father, he's still a husband, he's still got his own life going on. So, and when I was holding maybe a grudge against that person, it was only damaging me. He probably didn't really care, you know.
He might not have even known.
Well, I think he did. Oh. Yeah, I kind of let him, you know, I kind of have a good way of letting people know that, you know, I'm not, you know, I'm not going to suffer their bullshit, really. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Now, I've been on a mission for 17 years to help as many people on this planet get better financial knowledge. If, like me, you'd like to make, manage and multiply more money, I recommend that you join my digital financial freedom platform. It's really easy to join. You just type in rob.team. There, you're going to learn my four M's of making, managing, maintaining and multiplying more money. And the even better news is there's no risk to you because it costs less than 20 pence a day to join. You can cancel anytime. Join right now. I'll also give you my 12-week Money Mastermind University completely for free. It exposes the banking system and teaches you how to play them at their own game. If you join rob.team right now, you get that completely for free. Just type in rob.team. We'll see you inside with the 10,000 other members in rob.team.
And I'm a lot better at suffering people's bullshit now, but I just pacify them now. I just kind of go, oh, yeah, okay, cool. Whereas before I'd be like, oh, do you know, I want them to know that I think they're not, that I'm not really down with them. So, but no, I'm a lot more gentler now. And also I think as well with faults, like I was talking about faults in snooker, you know, you can kind of grab onto them. But with Buddhism, it's kind of like you don't try and get rid of them, but you just, it's like a conveyor belt. Imagine like an Amazon of parcels going by. Every one of them parcels is a different thought, but you just let them go. And you look at them and they go and they go. And it's like you're training your mind to just kind of not deny them, but I'm not grabbing at them. You know, I'm not going to let them take hold of me. So, you know, it's a little bit like a Navy SEAL. You're training yourself to be able to perform under the most extreme pressures. And a lot of the stuff you do off the table benefits you on the table. So you kind of, as a sportsman, you're always looking, you always perform your best when you're content, you're relaxed, but you're ready to fight. You know, you have to be ready to fight, because if you haven't got that fighting spirit in you, then you can never really dominate your opponent, you know, because it's a tough world. You know, it's a tough sport, any sport, and only the fittest survive. So, you know, I never try to deny that fight in me, because that fight has got me through my career and has made me a tenacious, competitive opponent. And that's what's, you know, that's the most important thing. But within that, I think you can kind of do it and have peace as well, you know?
Mm. So we found you saying that, and again, correct me if these are right or wrong.
Yeah.
I was the king of self-sabotage. Yeah. Is that something you said, and what did you mean by that?
I didn't know it. I really didn't know it until I started working with Steve Peters. And then he went to one of the first times he met, he said, you know, you go into sabotage mode. And I was like, wow, I do. And it's like I said to you, like, I get to Thursday and I'm like, I'm out of here. But that's sabotage. That wasn't, I mean, Steve calls it the chimp, so you've got the human and the chimp, and my chimp would be like, you know what, I can't stand the pressure, I'm not going to beat this guy, even if I get through this match, I'm going to lose on Friday, I might as well lose today, I might as well, you know, go home, have a few drinks, you know, have a barbecue, you know, so that's a form of sabotage, because I was grabbing on to them thoughts, and I believed they were really real, and it wasn't until after the game, so just say I've sabotaged the game, I'd get back to my room, I'd feel really, you know, all right about it, but then an hour later I'd thinking, what an idiot, you know, I could have tried a bit harder, I could have stuck in that match, and I quite gutted that I'm not going to be playing tomorrow.
Yeah.
And it was kind of, I was allowing that sabotage thoughts to take over, and since working with Steve Peters, he's made me realise that that's all bollocks. You know, them sabotage thoughts are not me. That's just the pressure, the situation. And that's me just going, I'm running for the exit door. Now I don't run for the exit door. I go, yeah, things might not be going for me, but I'm here to fight. And I'm here to fight to the last ball. And if I lose, I shake my opponent's hand and I go, you know what, well done. You done well. So I've got no regrets. And I think pre-working with Steve Peters, I would sabotage 13 times a year. And then the other.
You've got like a system.
Yeah. 13 times I would bail out. I'd go, right, I'm going for the exit door. I wouldn't say I'm going for the exit door, but that was what it is, fight, flight, or freeze. And I would freeze or I would flight. I'd be like, I'm out of here. And since working with Steve Peters, which has been 10 years now, it's a decade, which is a long time, and he's one of my favourite humans. I love him. Yeah. I really, really do. And he's helped me so much. I reckon I've sabotaged maybe 4 or 5 times in them 10 years. So that's a lot. So if you say like 13 times a year times 10, that's 130 sabotages. I've cut 130 down to 5 sabotages.
That's good skills.
So, and it just shows in the amount of tournaments that I've won since working with Steve Peters, because I've just learned to just fight, you know, and stay calm. Fight and stay calm. You know, and that's really what sabotage is all about, you know, and I just apply it into a lot of other things that I do in life, because, you know, I don't like too much hard work. I sometimes want to run away from it, but now I just face it and realise that if I do my best, that's enough.
What do you want your legacy to be and how you're remembered?
I don't know, really. I look at other players and I wish there's probably like 7, 8, 10 players that I wished I played like. So for me, it's like when I watch someone do something, I think, oh, they make it look easy, they make it look good, do you know what I mean? And I sometimes don't feel like I do, although a lot of people say I do. The game, it can be a bit of an effort for me to find that sort of, you know, to you know, I'm very hit and miss basically. So if I'm on, brilliant. If I'm off, you know, I can tough it out, but it's not my style really. But I think, you know, there's been times in my career when I look back and I just think, you know, I was flying then, you know, it was as good as it could get, you know, and just to have them moments on the table over such a long period of time, you know, because anyone can win a world title once, I'd say anyone, you know, any top 30 professional, possibly twice. But to win it 7 times, to win UK 7 times, win the Masters 7 times, to win all these tournaments, to keep coming back, you know, competing against younger, great players, you know, and you know, that for me is probably my greatest sort of legacy, I suppose, in many ways.
The late Shane Warne said that how you play the game is as important as how good you are at the game.
Yeah, I totally agree with it.
You'd agree with that?
Yeah, I think it's how you play the game, you know. Stephen Hendry taught me so much. Not like we sit down and talk. I observed, you know. He wasn't going to give me that privilege to kind of educate me, you know. And why should he, you know? So for me, it was like, this is the greatest snooker player there's ever been. I just have to watch, observe. What is he doing, you know? And some of it was off the table. A lot of it was on the table. And my biggest lesson came in. I can't remember what year it was. We played in the semi-finals and we had a cracking match. And we got to the final session and he just played a different game. I was like, fucking hell, mate. You know what I mean? I went one way, he went the other. And that was the biggest lesson that I'd had in snooker. And I then went away and realised that if I was to be where, play the game, Harry, and win the titles, you know, when it gets to the crunch, because anyone can play well for 3 rounds of golf. But when it comes to the final round, you've got to do it. A lot of them bail out, do you know what I mean? And that's the difference between great champions that win a lot and people that still win but don't, you know, like Tiger Woods at golf. If he was in the mix coming down, you go, it's done. You know what I mean? They're all going to collapse, you know. But he wouldn't. And Hendry was like that. And I had to realise that I had to play a certain way when it got to them crunch moments. And from that day onwards, I changed as a player. My mentality changed and I became more like him. And so, yeah, I think that was, like, the biggest sort of lesson for me, really, in snooker.
And when you say it got to those moments you had to play a different way, what was that?
Well, he just
way?
Got more aggressive.
Right.
In the most intense pressure situations where I'm sitting there thinking, oh, I don't want to make a mistake. He was just going for shots that I was just sitting there thinking, yeah, go for it. But he got them. And he kept getting them, and he kept getting them. And that was what made him... made him such a great champion. And then I watched other sports. So I didn't just watch snooker. Then I'd kind of go, okay, well, he's the king of our sport and he does X, Y, and Z. And I watch other sports and they're the king of their sport because they do it. And it's hard to do. It's hard to go, you know what, I'm going to I'm gonna turn the heat up when it's really a crucial part of the game. So we watched the golf last week, and I know McIlroy was four up, and the other guy was four up. But they were nursing the lead. You could just see it. It was and all of a sudden they forget about the guy that's coming. And all of a sudden it's too late. And it's you don't play the scoreboard. You don't, you just play the golf course. You just don't, forget who's around you. I'm here, and I'm just, So I see it in other sports where they call it choking, and that's what a lot of sports people do. They're good. They win tournaments. They have their day. But it's about having your day when you're not feeling good and it ain't going your way. You kind of make it happen, and that's what Hendry was better than anybody at doing,
You said you learned stuff from him off the table. What was the off the table stuff?
Well, the biggest lesson for me was he lost in a tournament. He was in Birmingham, and he lost, I think, in the quarterfinals or something. And the next tournament was in Thailand. And the next morning, I've come into practice, and at 10 o'clock in the morning, he was on the practice table for 2 hours before he got his connecting flight. And I was like, if I lost, I was in the bar having a drink, having a good time, and I wouldn't look at snooker table for 2 days. Mm. And I was just like, how do you do that? And it was just his discipline, his professionalism, as well as his great ability, because he had tons of ability. But just he turned him into this winning machine, And probably a lot of that was to do with his manager, who was a very tough Scotsman, who wouldn't allow him to socialise with certain people. There was a rule, you're in at 10 o'clock, you go home at 5 o'clock, Monday to Friday, it's a job. A lot of players turn up, play on a fruit machine, have a laugh and a joke. Hendry never done any of that. Mm. So I kind of learned that, if you wanted to be like him and have his success, then I had to adopt a lot of his lifestyle habits, if you like,
Mm. And is there any snooker player that you saw that was doing that on you, learning from you, and you all of a sudden...
Yeah.
Who would you say?
Yeah, listen, you don't notice people watching you, but they are. And obviously, a lot of players, I read interviews about them, they go, no one practices hard as Ronnie, no one does this more than Ronnie. So obviously they're watching, or they talk, or they, and that's fine. I want to be able to lead a good example for other snooker players. I want them to know that, because it's this thing, they go, oh, that's right, he's talented, and he just gets out of bed and plays. It doesn't work like that, I have to put in the hard graft, I have to do a lot of the stuff, and it's good that I think other snooker players recognise that and kind of respect you more for that side than just your talent. Because talent is, you're born with that maybe, you get that gift, but, hard work and discipline is about motivating yourself and kind of doing stuff that when you probably don't feel like doing it, So, that was, that had to be instilled in me as well. So my dad was very good at sort of, making me into that sort of person. But then when he went to prison, I just lost my way. But then I had to kind of, Peter helped me. One of the biggest lessons I had was with Peter as well. When I first met Peter, I went to his house in Brighton, and it was lovely. He was out in the middle of the country somewhere, and he put a Michael Jordan video on, and he just walked out of the room and left me there for about 3 hours. I watched 3 hours of Michael Jordan, and just had this fellow, just like this skinny kid that was like just about make the college team, to like in the gym shooting for 2-3 hours after everybody had gone home, just honing his skill in. At the end of it, I was like, I've got work to do. Do you know what I mean? This is Michael Jordan, some skinny little kid that wasn't the best in his college, but become the greatest basketball player of all time. So ability, yeah, he had some sort of ability, but it was the hard work, it was the discipline, it was the commitment to keep doing it. And like that was one of the biggest lessons I had. Mm. From Peter, it was great, and I kind of, from that day onwards, I got serious about, changing my lifestyle, if you like, Mm. Not becoming boring, but just becoming more, into my sport, Mm. Yeah, covering every base,
Mm. So in our research, it's estimated that you've made over £12 million in snooker winnings. Mm. Do you keep count of the money? Did you even know that?
No, not really. I never really look at anything like that, like the statistics of snooker. Like I said, I always played just for the love of the sport, to try and win the titles. And just for me, it's just, I like playing, I like competing, I like performing, I like entertaining the crowds. I might say entertaining the crowds, I like the buzz that I feel when there's a crowd. If I'm on it, I know deep down that they're enjoying it as well. You know what I mean? Because if I'm having a good time, I know they're having a good time. And I know, because I've seen a lot of snooker players, and I know that they don't do it how I do it. And I just think, well, that's nice to be able to let other people. So that's why I love doing the exhibitions. I go to a club, and it's like this dirty old club, because that's what snooker clubs are. Proper grimy, but I love them because it takes me back to when I was a kid and I was in these dark snookers where you could smell the carpet, the this, the that. And I go there and there's like 150 people and all sitting there and they're all dressed up, they're all looking forward to the night, and I think, you're going to get a good night tonight. And I go bang, 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 bang. And you can introduce them going, oh, oh, oh. And when I'm hitting the ball, it's like making a lovely noise, and then I open the balls up and I put it down there and they go, oh. And you're like, and I'm enjoying it. Because I'm thinking, this geezer's having an orgasm, you know what I mean? Like, he's been with his missus for 20 years, and he's forgot what it's like to have an orgasm. And yet he's come to watch me play snooker, and this geezer's getting really excited. And I see him at the end of it, and they go, oh, mate, that's unbelievable, why you hit that. Oh, I've never watched everyone play, but no one does it like, you know, I go. And I get it, and I love that he's paid maybe 70, 800 quid for a ticket. And I think, that's a cheap night. Mm. He's had a great night. He's gone home and thought, wonderful. And that's a great feeling to be able to do that. It's like actors, they go on TV, they do what they do, but when you get on theatre and in stage and you've got a live audience like that, and it's not televised, but it's just raw, and you can do stuff that I do in an exhibition, I get excited by that, you know? I love that feeling, you know?
Yeah, you can see that.
Mm. Yeah.
Right. Tony Knowles says, you're not the best snooker player ever. So do you think you are? No. And if you don't, who do you think?
No, he was right. He was right. Really? Yeah. John Higgins for me is the greatest snooker. Listen, it's very hard for me because growing up, Hendry was my hero. Davis was my hero. But Hendry, kind of, you couldn't ignore what Hendry done in the sport. So he kind of become my new hero. And I went, you know what? He is the king of snooker. And if I didn't have that admiration for Hendry, because I was a kid looking up to Hendry, I was 14, he was 21, he was world champion. I was like, he's who I want to be. Me and John Higgins were the same age. But if John Higgins was 7 years older than me, I probably would have said John Higgins is the greatest snooker player I've ever seen. Because he, like I said earlier in the interview, he's the most complete player. If he was going to build a snooker player, John Higgins would be what you would build. You'd go, you know what, he's going to last the test of time, he's definitely going to win the world championship, he's definitely going to be number one, he's definitely going to, when he's on, he's unplayable. You know, it's like, if you was a betting man, bet on John Higgins for the rest of your life, because you'd be a very wealthy man. But if you start to bet on Ronnie, you know, it could go good, it might not go good, it's a bit of a risk, like, you'll have a few sleepless nights. You don't get that with John Higgins. So when Tony Knowles said that, and Graham Dott said that as well, I was like, yeah, I totally agree with you. I can't not, you know, but what I've kind of managed to do, and I thank John Higgins because he's inspired me to be a better player. I looked at him and thought, I'm never going to be as good a safety player, but I need to try and improve in my safety to, you know, if he's at 10, if I can get to 8, that's enough. Whereas before I was at 2 or 3, I need to get that up to 8, you know what I mean? And he's inspired me to become a better player. To become a different player, to become a better match player. But yeah, I totally agree. John Higgins is probably the best player that I've ever played. But it's hard because obviously Hendry's my hero, and I've took some good idings off of Hendry, but I was early in my career then and Hendry was in his peak. Whereas John Higgins, we're both the same age, so we kind of like, no one had an advantage because we were both, it's like a Formula One car, the two Mercedes going head to head. You know, there was no one had an advantage. We both come up in the same era. And yeah, for me, he's the most complete player I've ever seen.
Mm. Great.
Right. And I don't feel bad about saying that, you know.
No.
Maybe I couldn't have admitted that 15 years ago, 20 years ago, because like you say, that would have been a weakness. That would have been like, probably that's not the sort of thing I'd want John Higgins to have known when he was 21, 22, because he would have probably gained strength from it. But now I'm 45 and I don't really care. I can sit down at a table and go, you know what, John, you actually were a better player than me. Yeah. I know I've got more tournaments and won whatever, but I just think that's just through, I don't know what it was through. Maybe I'm a better player than I give myself credit for. I don't know. And maybe my style of play, I could beat certain players a lot easier than John Higgins' style of play. You know, like I'm a bit like, I'm either on or I'm off. I either blow people away or I get blown away. So I think, Yeah, I can't quite work out why he hasn't won more than me, but, you know, we've both done pretty well.
Yeah, I bet if you ask some of them who's the greatest player that's ever lived, they'd say you.
Yeah, I mean, like, if you said, like, you know, John Higgins, he'd probably say, you know, me, you know, Hendry, maybe, you know, a lot of people say maybe it's Selby. I don't really know. But, yeah, I think a lot of the snooker fans that don't really know the intricacies of the game would probably all say me. But then if you get people that really know the game, they would probably either say me, Hendry or Higgins. Us three would be the three that they would kind of, you know, if you had like 100 people, you'd probably get 30 say Ronnie, 30 say Higgins and 30 say Hendry and yeah, whatever, you know. Maybe a lot of the snooker fans kind of like, because of my style and like I said, the way I do it, and they just go, oh, I love the way Ronnie plays, and they all want to play like me, they're all like the Rocket and this and that. And so I'll get that vote, if you like, but if you just break it down into pure skill, tenacity, temperament, you know, I'd say Higgins and Hendry have got a much better temperament than me. I've just managed to sort of, I think it's my Italian sort of passion that has kind of drove me through, and I've played from emotion. Most of the time I play from emotion, whereas John and Hendry, they're like tough Scotch people. They're unbreakable, yeah, you know, whereas me, I fall apart, but then I build myself back up and I fall apart and I build myself up, and everyone's like, oh, has he done that one week? And then he looks all right this week, yeah, you know. So, but, you know, I think that's what kind of draws people to give me the nod, if you like, of being the best player that's ever played, I suppose.